Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's Saturday, October 12th, 2013, and welcome to episode 60, woohoo, of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, and collecting. I'm Earl Evans, speaking to you from the secret RCR lair, buried deep within the Pacific Northwest. Joining us today is the world-renowned Dr. Stephen Wyrick, knower of all Apple II things that are knowable. Hello, Dr. Steve.
Hello.
It's great to have you on the podcast today. Thanks.
Oh, it's nice to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Our pleasure. Our pleasure. And you'll have to pardon, it was probably edited out, but I can't seem to pronounce your last name right for the life of me. So now I know why I can't pronounce it right.
A lot of people have that problem.
Well, I'm over it now. Also, we have allowed Arrington K. Anstonvay to join us once again. And how could we not? I mean, after all, his check did clear.
And we still check properly up here in my country. So
with a Q-U-E.
Absolutely, the way the Queen demands right. That it is spelled.
That is the right spelling, Flavor. So
I can hear the delicious extra U in that word. Nicely done, Earl.
So, hey there, Carrington, what say you?
I say everything is great. The sun is shining. It's motorcycle riding weather here in Toronto. Having a wonderful time. Looking forward to the show.
Nice. Well, beautiful. Hey, you know, we're actually getting a little bit of sun here, too, which is kind of weird for mid-October in Portland, but I will take it.
Sure.
So, on we go to the items of interest. And they're very interesting. I get to pick the host topic today because I'm the host. And so, ergo, QED, I picked the topic. And
the
today,
topic is butchery of Latin.
It is. How does the... I'll let you guys go first, woo-hoo, and then I will go after. So how does the maker movement of today, because it's all over the place, I think the maker fairs are getting record numbers of people going to them, and there's all kinds of different projects coming out. It's not just electronics, but it is in large part electronics. Microcontroller-based systems tend to be dominant here, but just general electronics. So I'm curious what you guys think about how that hobby compares to what the computing world looked like in the 70s and 80s. Kind of compare and contrast and talk amongst yourselves.
Well, I'd say at that time, 75, 76, you had primarily your Heath kit builders, or the people with the ham radio operators, the people who already had been doing a lot of that building stuff anyway. That's where that came from. And when this computer microcircuit microprocessor kind of thing came in, I think they were the natural phase in from that.
Interesting. So was a maker?
Well, he was a maker in the sense that he was trying to design computers on paper long before he could actually afford to build any.
And then when he built it, it was his own design. I mean, something that he, nobody else had one. He didn't copy off of somebody else's schematics. I mean, this is kind of what I was thinking, is that the early computer revolution, there was a lot of excitement, and there's a lot of excitement today in this hobby maker revolution. What do you think, Carrington?
You're both wrong. No, actually, I completely agree, even though I want to be contrarian. I do think that there are direct and exact parallels between the early hacker and freaking culture of the 60s, 70s, and into the 80s, and current maker culture. And it's all about that original idea of hacker. Like, I'm going to take a thing, I'm going to, like, the way I used to use the word hacker, I'm going to make this thing do something I want it to do. I'm going to make a game, or I'm going to have it so when I push this button, a Coke machine pops out a Coke down at the end of the hallway, or I'm going to have lights that come on as I walk by and go off, or all those sorts of ideas of interacting with technology in a fun hacking sort of way is what I see maker culture being all about. Like, I see it as just, it's a continuation. It's the exact same thing. The people now in maker culture, if we made them be 30 years younger, would be the people going to the homebrew computer club in, you know, the 1970s. I think it's the same type of people wanting to do the same things. The big difference, I think, is that geek culture has become chic in a sense. It's much more well known. Hacker culture, when I grew up with it, was Revenge of the Nerds time, where nerd right. was sort of an insult. You didn't go around proudly calling yourself a nerd because you were a hot girl who put on non-prescription glasses. Like, it's a different thing. So there's an edge to maker culture that like a periphery rather than an edge. So there's a periphery around it that I think is a little sensationalized and certainly much more well marketed and branded in a hipster sort of way. So I think that the core of maker culture, when I think of people that are like Quinn Dunkey and people that are making their own computers, who are hacking together electronics, who are playing with Arduinos, who are grabbing, like, Raspberry Pi. If I was to say maker culture in two words, Raspberry Pi. The type of people for whom a Raspberry Pi appeals are the makers of the 1970s and 80s. It's the same sort of people. I do think on the outside of that, you've got Time magazine talking about maker culture, and you've got and it doesn't have the negative connotation of hacker who can't get a date and lives in his basement. He says, from bitter experience, it's like, instead, I think it's more accepted, it's more mainstream. So I think there's all those aren't necessarily. I don't mean to say that those are negative things. I think it makes me sound more bitter than I really am. So I think the difference between maker culture and hacker culture isn't what's inside the culture. I think it's the same ideals, the same ideas, the same sort of people, same sort of personalities, the same goals, the same fun at the end of the day. That's the most important thing. Same fun, right, and same type of fun. But the outside of it, the view from the rest of society, I think is more aware, less negative, less fearful. I think people sometimes forget the idea of, like, oh, it's when you look at movies like hackers, they're going to crash airplanes, they're going to take over things, it's bad, it's dangerous. You don't really see a lot of that in movies about hackers.
That's because that's how Hollywood has chosen to portray those people. And there are, of course, some people out there who've taken the hacker name on themselves who have done harmful things with what their hacking skills. I mean, I also think, you know, again, getting back to what I'd mentioned, I think of the hacker, the geek people, the nerd people, whatever. Those would have been the ones who were in the AV club in high school, who may have been the ones who, they would be the ones who'd want to run the movie projector, you know, when there's a movie in the class, back in the day before we had VCRs everywhere. Mm-hmm. You know, that sort of a thing would be what those are the people I would kind of see that. And they'd be the people who I mentioned Heathkit before. I mean, that's kind of where I got my own introduction into, wow, what you could do, all this kind of stuff. Heathkits were great because they were so simple that you had to really try hard to mess up to do a Heathkit wrong. And you get that thing working. It's like, wow, look at the power I've got with this thing I built. I want to build something else. And so that could get you into the whole idea of learning how it works and what it does. And the other thing that's different about the maker movement of today versus the geek or nerd culture of 30, 40 years ago is that the whole social media thing, it's so easy to find out about this. You could have somebody who's in a school in, say, West Elbow, Nebraska, who he's the only one who's really interested in this kind of stuff. There's nobody else, maybe one other person does it. And knows nothing about what's going on in a school in, say, Chicago where there are, you know, 20 people that are interested in that because it's a
really
big school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well put. Yeah, I didn't even think of that. That's a huge difference.
Having the internet makes it possible for all these people to talk to each other and share the information and actually kind of accelerate the growth of it.
So they can connect, and society looks at them differently than society looked at them before.
Right.
But on the inside, the things are the same. There's a little bit of counterculture and a lot of intellectual curiosity, ingenuity.
I think there's a little less counterculture than there was. It doesn't feel as counter now as it did then.
I think so, too, although I would propose one thing on this, that today, and I see this with my own kids, that we live in an emerald city where you've got tablets and smartphones and computers everywhere. I don't even know if I want to count the number of computers in my house, and I'm not just talking about retro computers, and devices all over the place, but they're very well curated. You pick them up, and they're expected to just work, mm-hmm. and most of the time they do. Just work, but you don't really know what makes them tick. And so in this sense, I think maybe there's a little, maybe I shouldn't call it counterculture, but maybe a little lighthearted rebellion that I want to actually build something that I know how it works.
Well, and they can figure out things to do with it that are more, certainly more elaborate than one could figure out what to do with transistors and resistors and capacitors, you know, all those years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But the maker movement, though, is inherently about making stuff. I think it's totally separate from just the consumer level use of consumer electronics. I mean, people back then bought radios and televisions, and for the most part, just to turn them on and watch them or listen to them. I think it's a totally different thing. So, but there's a lot of computers now that are lumped into that and are used that way. Like my sister is outside of the maker movement. She just wants to have a computer, turn it on, and, you know, I can send email, I can surf the web, I can watch Netflix and get on Facebook. And that's a consumer use of a consumer device. It's totally different than somebody saying, I have this computer and I want to increase its RAM. Even at the most basic level like that, my family comes to me and says, make this be faster, make this stop crashing. And I think that, so it's a different, but I think the people that are in the maker movement, that whole idea, whether you're hardcore in it and you go to hacker spaces all the time, or you're just like sort of vaguely interested in, and have bookmarked the Arduino page and are thinking about it, that impulse is what sort of separates the maker culture and the old school, you know, hacker culture from just general consumer interest. Some people just aren't interested in that. In the same way that I'm really not interested in a lot of other hobby. Like, I'm not interested in sports at all. Outside of sports culture completely. I've hockey. I know that one, and I know my local team, but I couldn't name five
curling,
football players.
Right?
I do, actually. I could name more curling players than football players, and I can't name a lot of curling players, maybe six. So, I'm outside of that culture completely, and so I understand it. I see it, and I see it in the media all the time, but I'm fully removed from it. And I think maker culture, though, is all about the hands-on stuff.
And getting into the maker culture also involves having something that you actually can manipulate and adjust and change. You know, I get back to, I used to take apart radios and take apart televisions. Didn't build any of those things. Oh, I built a shortwave radio from Heathkit. But, I mean, I take apart those things, look at how they work, look at the things. And in those old TVs, there were a lot more adjustment things that you could do, that you could use to fiddle with the settings than there are in TVs today. Today is pretty much, you know, contrast and color and what, you know, cable connector you're going to use. But back then, there was the horizontal hold, the vertical hold. You could really mess up the picture if you wanted to, you know, play tricks with people.
The chance of implosion and death.
Yes, that's
more exciting
time. So with our newer stuff where everything is, like you say, so curated and so self-contained, I think that's where somebody says, hey, look at this Raspberry Pi. I can use it to, you know, fill in the blank. I can use it to do this or this or this. Even though it's such a small device, there's not really much adjustment hardware-wise you make with it. You plug things into it, but you can make software-wise adjustments in it that will let you do cool things on it. It's gotten to the level of sophistication, just like this. The radios of the 1970s were so much more sophisticated than the radios of the 1930s. You know, they didn't require a lot of hand-holding to make them work. They just worked. The computers of today don't require the hand-holding that the computers of the 1970s required.
But I think the same people that for whom back in the day, back in my childhood, in the mid 1400s, that for whom it appealed, like the idea of freaking a telephone system or the idea of, you know, just getting a computer. Like back then, getting a computer was this weird thing. Well, here's a box. It has potential. Learn to code or you're on your own. Like, and that appealed to me. I love that idea. And I think the kind of, you know, periphery nerd, hacker, maker people, that same personality, that same goal, that same fun, that same sense of exploration and curiosity, that's what's driving the heart of maker culture. I see it is, a lot of overlap, and I see a lot of parallels. So I do think it's exactly the same sort of thing. And it really is just, it's the same. I don't think it went away. I think it's been here continuously. Just, it got picked up. It became chic. It got a name. It got a magazine. Got this whole maker idea. And I think it, because of marketing and because of what you were saying, Doctor, that there's that connection now. There's so much easier to find other people into it. I had BBSs, but now there's the internet. You know, best BBS ever. And it's so much easier to find out what somebody else is doing. It's so much easier. $35, bingo, you got yourself a Raspberry Pi. I mean, just, it's sort of easier to get on these things. And so I think it's less barrier to entry, but the same retro goodness, I think, is right at the heart of it. When I see a Raspberry Pi, it feels just like an old school computer to me.
Yes.
And I see that as such a positive thing, that there's, from a technical, information, and societal perspective, less barriers to entry across the board, seems like what you guys are saying.
That is what we're saying.
And that's very cool. I love that. Well, thank you. That was a very stimulating conversation. And as always, I learned some new viewpoints from you guys. So at that point,
we're going to edit out all of the racist stuff that Dr. Steve said, though, right?
Yeah. And
thank you. I appreciate that.
And that constant stream of profanity from you, Carrington.
Well, I would assume you're going to bleep and edit that, all of my bleeping words.
That's on the cutting room floor for sure. All right. But, you know, but then again, I'm going to turn the mic over to you. Again, I never learn.
It's risky.
So that you can tell us about Cloud Paint.
Well, I'm sure when I say Mac Paint, you and our listeners know what I'm talking about. When
I do.
Yeah, when we think like old school, truly original Macintosh software, Mac Paint is one of the ones that jumps to mind. Like, so if you think you got a toaster Mac, you're sitting there with your original, like even the Mac Plus is in the future. You're going to sit on something, a Fat Mac maybe, an original 128. One of the key pieces of software, one of the things that said, hello, I'm a Macintosh, and here's what I do that's different than everything else, was Mac Paint. And I find this really exciting that somebody has not just ported this, but made accessible on the net at cloudpaint.com. There is an online version of Mac Paint. And it's not just the middle part. Like, it really is sort of emulating the whole thing. You see the window, you have the menus, the goodies, and it's just an instant reminder of being back in the literally black and white world of the original 9-inch Fat Mac or original Toaster Macs. And I just love it. I just loved playing with it. I don't know what I'm going to do with it, really. And I was really excited when I spotted this, and I spotted it early, as soon as it got launched. And then it got picked up by a couple of blogs. Then it got put on Daring Fireball, and I thought, oh, everyone knows, but I'm still choosing it as the first thing I want to talk about because I thought it was totally exciting. So if you've never played with a serious old school Macintosh, like System 6 on a 9-inch black and white screen, like nothing will give you that feel like a piece of software like Mac Paint. So if you just go to cloudpaint.com, we'll have a link in the show notes. You can feel that, like use the menus and see how menus were different then than now. Like you had to hold down that mouse button to keep them down, and just the tool. And so much of this, well, it seems old. It's amazing how much this set the stage. You can sort of see Photoshop here, because the idea of tools and toolbar and like all of that, to me, this is what introduced me to that, having the various fonts and I'm going to choose this fill and I'm going to choose this pattern and I'm going to paint with it. And all of that is something I do all the time now in things like Photoshop. So this is just a very forward looking piece of software at the time. And so I just think it's exciting. And I was just, you know, really, really fun site to play around with.
Yeah, that is pretty cool to look at. It is very, very early Mac-like.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the top right corner, you'll see when you're on there, there are a couple of buttons. There's a 1X button. If you click it, it just doubles everything to 2X, which is a nice big size to work with. And on my screen, it makes it basically about the size of what the original screen was like, actually a little bit bigger. What I like about this in particular is it's very easy when you're on a website or on a modern computer to take screenshots, to save bits of screens, that kind of stuff. So if you're looking to make old-school Macintosh graphics using old-school fonts and patterns and then use it in something modern, like this is a great free online toolkit for doing that. So that's what I might use it for if I wanted. I can imagine doing like some Macintosh site and I wanted something that was artwork taken from an old Mac. Like this is a great way to do that up and make something look like a HyperCard stack or something. So it's exciting.
Definitely.
It's interesting how useful that a paint program was, even though it was on a monochrome system.
Sure. And also it was just fun. It really just showed you like using the tools. It was awesome.
Mm-hmm.
It was very primitive at the time, but still was way easier making pictures and things on there than it was on your typical computer that preceded it.
Oh, absolutely. We had some Mac Pluses in my PC support department. We used it to produce our department newsletter, used Mac Paint all the time for cool stuff, and then you could just paste it right into Word, not Word, Mac Write, which was handy.
When the world was 72 dots per inch.
It was, yes. And loving it. So, Steve, I heard this interview also. I thought it was fantastic. So you put it here. Why don't you chat about what you heard on the Antic podcast?
Well, what brought this to mind was heard on the Antic Atari podcast. They had an interview at the end with a game programmer, Chris Crawford, and he wrote games for, I think, the Atari 2600 as well as for the Atari 800. And it was just interesting listening to his recollections of making a game and what he did with it and, you know, how he went off later and made his own games on his own. And dovetailing into that was actually the interview that Carrington remembers so well from No Quarter that was with the guy who helped who programmed Rampage, the arcade game. And what interested me about it was and this is something that fit with everybody who was doing things with computers at that time, was that you took what you had, that limited memory space, the limited disk drive, the speed, the graphics that didn't do a billion colors, and you made it do what you could. You did the best you could with it to make something that still came out cool. And the tricks you'd have to do to make something fit into the space, I think, didn't the guy who did Rampage say he made the one character that was a wolf, Ralph, he made him out of the other character because it saved memory space.
Yeah,
and
he reused the graphics. I still say Ralph sucks, but yes.
it reused the graphics. It let him fit a third character in there, and it just worked with what he had available. If he'd had, you know, tons of space and tons of memory, the game may not have been as efficient as it was. And, you know, it goes with, you know, what Chris Crawford said about him programming those things. It has to do, I'm sure, with people who are doing Apple II games and Commodore games so on, that you had an idea about what you wanted to do, and you made it with what was available. And if you had the huge space we have today, you could have drowned in all of the abilities, all the things that you could do, instead of focusing on making it a good game.
Mm, yes, that was a really good interview too. Antic is a great podcast. Our listeners should definitely be subscribing to that. I'm not even remotely an Atari guy, but I love that podcast. Like it's just, I just think it's fantastic.
Yes.
So you're also good at talking about a Homebrew Computer Club Kickstarter, right? Which I did not know about. So I'm glad you're linking to.
It just popped up in my newsfeed today. That there's a Kickstarter for somebody who, Joel Frenusik, it says on here, who wanted to create a one-night reunion of surviving Homebrew Computer Club members. They want to get together at the Computer History Museum on November 11th of this year, 2013, and get these people together. And part of the reason for the Kickstarter was to, you know, make it happen. And then if they reach certain goals, they're talking about having some photographs taken, and maybe even a little, if they stretch goals, they could try to make a micro documentary of it, and so on. But when I looked at it this morning, it was at like the goal they had was 16,000. I think they were at 11,000. Now this afternoon, it's up to 22,000. Still has 16 days to go.
Yes, already been quickly funded.
Yes. So they've got, and of course, the only picture they show on there, they have a video. I haven't watched the whole video. They have a video. They have the one photograph that they have of the homebrew meeting. Nobody else took a picture of it, but that one picture is on the start of the video for it. And it just seems like it'd be a cool thing.
It's a great idea for an event. Yeah, absolutely. I like a couple of things about this. I like the idea for the event. Sounds like a terrific bit of history. I love this idea. I also like that the pledge levels are powers of two. Like it's $64 for a ticket, but $128 for two. Then they go $512. So I was like, you know what? That's pretty sweet. I like that little detail.
And you start at $4.
Exactly.
Start at $4.
But $4 just gets you after the event. You get like a postcard.
Postcard.
So it's $64 bucks to go, and it is only a 3.5 hour event. So you know it's not super cheap, but it's still $64 for most large events. It's, you know, that's not outrageous. I think it's really fun. If I was going to be in the area, I probably would be going because, you know, why not?
And the people whose names are on there that I recognize is like Lee Felsenstein is one of the Felsenstein. I'm not sure if I got the name right. Was one of the people who started. He was one of the original moderators for the Homebrew Club. Mm-hmm. And Matt Spergel, I've heard his name before. I don't recognize the other names that are on here, but it's just cool that they're planning on something like this. You know, this is the era where it's like we need to remember. This is where a lot of the stuff really got kicked off for the small home computing stuff.
And of course, Steve Wozniak will be there, but he goes everywhere.
That's right.
This, I have to take a different opinion. This event is really bumming me out.
Oh, is it? Why is that?
It's because it's within striking distance of me, but I don't know if I'm going to be able to break the piggy bank to go to something like
this. It's not cheap. It's $64 per ticket. If you buy two of them, well, it's $128, so it's $64 bucks each.
Well, plus still, I'd have to get there. I'd have to stay the night. I'd have to get back.
I think even the people in the audience will be cool. I think it could be a fun gathering. The going to dinner beforehand or the next day or whatever, this could be really a fun thing.
And did you see what the 1,024 pledge was? You get two tickets and a personalized voicemail greeting by Captain Crunch.
Nice.
So John Draper is going to be there?
I guess so.
See, that's awesome.
Oh, fun.
So anyway, great. Yeah, I had not heard about this Kickstarter, so I'm really glad you talked about it. We'll have a link to that in the show notes, too. So really, really cool.
We will indeed. So the next thing I get to talk about, which is JS Mess. And it actually isn't really a mess. It's a little bit of a mess because it's still in beta. But folks who listen to our podcast are probably familiar with Mess, the multi-emulator software system or something like
super
that.
Super system.
Super system? Okay. I didn't know what it stood for, but it's pretty darn cool because it emulates just about everything. And Jason Scott has been promoting this effort to translate this to JavaScript. So you can go to this webpage, jsmess.textfiles.com.
And JS, I guess, stands for JavaScript, not Jason Scott.
Not Jason Scott, that's correct.
I always think it's Jason Scott's mess.
No, people clarified that.
Okay.
It's JavaScript. So you go here, and you can emulate a bunch of different old console systems and old retro computers and such all within your web browser. You don't have to install anything. You don't have to download anything. You just pick the program you want to run, and you click go, and there you go. Actually, you hit the space bar. And the simulation starts up, and you are emulating right within your browser. So I tried this for a couple different systems. I tried it for Atari 800. I tried it for Commodore 64. It worked good for me. I think I heard Kevin on the Antic podcast saying that he'd had trouble with one or two of the titles that he tried for the Atari 800. But
yeah, I think he was saying he couldn't get sound working.
Yeah, but the thing still is in beta, but I thought it was great.
I think it's a great idea, too. I think this is one of the best ideas for a way to make this sort of software and these systems accessible to the general public. Like, you don't need vintage hardware. You don't need to install anything. Go to this website and play Load Runner. Like, that sort of idea. So I think it was on Antic or some other podcast talking about this. They were saying, like, you know, you got the idea that you could write a magazine article. And I can imagine people on Creative Computing, and they talk about Load Runner. And you would just click a button, it would open a window, and you're playing Load Runner and pick your system. Oh, Apple II, of course. And you play it. Like, that sort of idea, I think, is really enabling in a way that I think is really exciting.
We talked just a few minutes ago about breaking down barriers to entry. So
no, we talked about building up barriers to entry. I'm sick of you people messing with my hackerspace.
So here again, we have a situation where if you want to let people see what it was like back in the day, now they can just go easily do it. So that should just, if nothing else, it should expand the awareness of what the old computers and consoles look like and how they played.
If the thing is really working, I had mentioned when I talked about this earlier before the show that I hadn't really tried MES much since I tried it years ago, because at that time it didn't work very well for me. But now if this is working better, I've always thought, well, I'd like to see what it was like to use, an Atari, use a C64, stuff like that, because I never really had access to them when I was younger. So just to see what the other people not using Apple IIs were dealing with, it'd be fun to do. And I know they had a lot of cool games for those other computers.
Mm-hmm.
There is the idea, though, like, and we've talked about this many times on this show in its various incarnations, right back to the very beginning, the idea of, is there value in emulation? Is there value in not using original hardware? What do you lose? And it's such a gray area, and I see so many pros and cons on both sides. But regardless, I do think that this is an exciting, and I don't think that this takes away at all from there's still actual Atari 800s you can go get and play with. Like, this doesn't remove that. So I don't see any real downside to this existing, and I think it's just exciting and enabling.
I see the huge list of things, not just the big players, the Apple, the Atari, the Commodore, and so on, but I see this list of all these others, the Othello Multivision FG-1000.
Which
What's
I will
that?
Never get access. Like I'd be fooling myself if I think I'm ever going to set one of those up and use it. No. Never.
You try one of these out here and you say, oh, that's what that was like. And if you happen to find something that say, this is amazing, I've got to get my hands on this, then at least you know before you bother dropping any money on this on eBay, this is something I want.
Hmm.
Cool. That's an interesting point, too. You could actually try before you buy.
Yes.
Fun. Well, anyway, we'll have that link up in the show notes. Go give it a shot. And do what Dr. Steve's suggesting there and try something that you've never tried before.
Yep.
I think I will do that myself. So the Center for Computing History, the momentum for this just keeps building.
Yep.
Hearing different things all the time about how they're making progress out there. What's this latest thing?
Well, the latest thing is they got a bunch of funding. They've got this 7,000-pound goal they've had a while so that they can expand. And we've talked about the Center of Computing History a bunch of times. In fact, I hesitated to put a link in and pick this as my second piece because we've talked about it a few times back when it was open. But this, I thought, was a particularly exciting thing because finally, over at this Cambridge News site, which is cambridge-news.co.uk, I got to see more of the inside of it the way it looks now because it's been this like mystery thing that I'm a big fan of, but I couldn't really visualize. So what I like about this article is the article itself is nice and it talks about how they got this most recent round of funding, which I guess lets them move into 24,000 square feet or something. So there's going to be another big expansion. So they keep doing wonderful things and keep getting wonderful stuff. But this link in particular lets you open up a slideshow and see a bunch of photographs of the way it looks at the moment. And it's very different than the last time I got to see it. And it just made me want to go to there very badly because it just looks great. It reminded me, in fact, of the pop-up Apple Museum that David et al. Had arranged for the Vintage Computer Festival Northwest, was that? Which one was it?
Southeast,
Northwest. one of those things. It was
I wish we had a Northwest.
Southeast. But that,
time zones and geography are an issue for
you. Yeah, but that idea where it's a nice, clean space, almost sort of like an Apple store, but like with the tables and everything laid out, but you can get up near things, and here you can really get on things. So it's a nice, clean look with lots of great hardware that I didn't even recognize at first. And I'm looking through the slideshow thinking, what's that? Well, what's that? So it really appealed to me. It looks fantastic. So it got me really excited. So I thought probably a lot of our listeners have heard us talk about the Center for Computing History as well, but probably themselves haven't had a glimpse on the inside of the current setup. So this link will give you a chance to take a look.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, if I'm ever across the pond, that's going to have to be one of that's like a must see.
I agree.
You say?
Yeah, definitely.
So a little closer to the North American continent here, We've got Vintage Computer Festival East 9.1 coming up in April of next year. Why is it called 9.1?
I think it's because they missed 2013 due to the weather damage from Hurricane Sandy.
Indeed. And so did you want to mention anything about that?
Just that it was it's coming, and it's kind of like you know, 9.1, at least in the U.S., that's, I think, one of the longest running versions of the same venue. And it's just that they couldn't do it this year, and they've got it coming next year. I just thought it was important to mention that it is coming.
Awesome.
And 2 years ago, or during, I guess it's 2 years ago now, the last time there was a VCF East, I had wanted to go. I had intended to go, and like last minute, I couldn't go. So I'm very excited that it's back, and I'm going to make sure that I actually get there this time. So I'm quite keen on it.
And I think I saw a news release from Evan Koblenz where they're extending it by a day. They're adding the Friday before the weekend, and there are going to be, I think, some sessions, some workshops that are going to be on that Friday.
Oh, sweet.
So,
yeah. Because usually it was just the weekend. I remember last time when I was going to go, it was going to be just the weekend. I had planned to go down Friday night, hang out there Saturday, see a bit on the Sunday, but have to leave early. So now I'm going to have to take even more time off work.
But it'll be worth it.
Because I mean, now I'm going to get to take even more time off work. It's all right. Said that with the wrong tone.
And you got another bullet point here, Dr. Steve, about internet resources.
Well, yeah, as I was finishing up the research on this Apple II history book that hope to be seeing actually out sometime very soon now, when I was just thinking about the difference between trying to research for it today versus researching for it years ago when it was based on, you know, some physical book I might purchase that talks about a little bit about my whatever I wanted to have to do with the Apple II. And in the last year and a half, it seems like there's all these resources that are popping up that weren't available even 2 or 3 years ago. I mean, for example, archive.org has some full scans of classic computer magazines. They've got I think they may have Classic Computing, but they have got Byte magazine. And I was looking for specific things, and sometimes I'm looking for, well, what was the date that this event happened? What's the date that event happened? And I don't really know for sure, but I found I could search through issues of Byte magazine and say, oh, here's the first time when there's an advertisement for this company. So this must be when this came out. I found it's fascinating looking at the advertisements in a 1976 issue of Byte. All the stuff for Chromemco and what they're advertising to use on your Altair or your MSI, and how it changed. You know, all these companies that I kind of remember, Godbout, they had these huge ads in magazines back in the day for the parts you could buy to build your stuff for the maker movement of the day, getting back to that topic. That's where you found your parts for doing these things. And so looking at the ads, looking at the things that had to do with it, when did this modem come out? Oh, yeah, here it is. There's an advertisement for it in this issue. So you have it was just helpful in getting the research to find a better idea about timelines on things. And another source that was great I give Google a lot of grief because of Android and being an Apple fan for the iPhone, but I have to say that they've taken time to scan in a bunch themselves. InfoWorld magazine has got stories that were current at the time talking about here's what's happening with Apple, here's what's happening with this company that made something for the Apple II, and you get the story, you know, right at the day that it was happening instead of trying to find somebody who can remember back that far.
Nice.
So great resources that you can get today that weren't available just a few years ago.
I agree. My two thoughts on that are, first, I'm totally with you there on looking at old ads. I used to love back in the day looking at advertisements. You sort of like Christmas shopping in your mind.
Yes.
I like it even more now looking at vintage ads. I love looking at the prices, looking at what was available, imagining, oh, if I could have had that at the time. I love old magazine ads for vintage computer stuff.
I still
stuff
have
now.
The feeling like I wish I could get this item.
Totally. And it's funny, when I was sitting at Kansas Fest, I was talking with somebody, it might have been Mike, somebody was there, and we were talking, we were looking through, I think it was Insider magazine at the ads, and saying about half of these items I would happily pay that price now for that item. If it was, I'm looking to go, oh my gosh, that's all you want for this? I'll totally take it. So like, you can't buy the things for that now, or things that I just never even heard of, and that I find really exciting. And the other thought was, I'm also completely with you on the fact that these things are searchable makes such a difference. I mean, having the scans available for casual reading is really fun, and I really value the different people out there that are doing high-res scans of magazines for archive and for keeping them. I think it's an important thing, and I'm really glad they're doing it. But I love the fact that like archive.org takes those extra steps where you can search things, and it'll highlight them in yellow and say, well, here's where that word is. That yes. Just for as a research tool makes these things now so much more useful. And even for me, it was a couple months ago on No Quarter, we were talking about something and I came across some article online and it just struck me as, I can't remember what the thing was, but it struck me as weird. Like there was a quote, I think about, and it was something seriously old school. I might have been actually on this podcast. I don't know. I'm on too many darn podcasts. On some podcast, maybe RCR. And the person had made a comment about how, oh, we don't see there being more than 10 of these in the future. And it struck me as one of those things that you always hear people said, but I don't think this guy would have said at that time. And I was able to use the archive.org links to the magazines and find the supposed article in which this was quoted, and that's not in there, and then found all these, and I said, well, no, that's total nonsense. And I was only able to do that because these people took the extra step of not just scanning things, but making them essentially be OCR'd in a way that they're searchable. So I really appreciate that. It's such a great research tool that I think is going to pay off dividends in the future in ways that we can't even imagine yet.
I mean, I have like four issues. I have maybe four copies of a Byte magazine that I kept for historical purposes because they had an article about the Apple IIgs or the Apple IIc, whatever. When I was looking for information from that issue, I didn't pull my issue off the shelf. I actually went to the archive.org because I could search for it. Hmm. I didn't have to look in the table of contents. I didn't have to peruse every page finding where that thing was. I just searched for the text and there it was.
Research things have always been that way. I remember very early, like I've now gotten to the point, I keep using the word gotten as if it's a real word. I have now found myself at the point where I read more fiction books digitally than in physical dead tree. I'm using my Kindle and my iPad more. I've long since switched over, which just is so convenient. But way before that, like as soon as research things were available digitally, like immediately my thought was, that's it for encyclopedias. Or that's it. Why would I possibly want something that I'm not reading for pleasure, that I'm reading for information searching? It's always going to be better digital. And it's not just digital, which like, you know, okay, I've scanned it. Now here's a photocopy of that. Well, that's the same. Digital and searchable is the key. And that's what makes something useful for research. So I'm just delighted that that places like archive.org have taken that, you know, considerable effort. They've gone to effort that I never would have gone to. So I just really appreciate it.
Yes.
Not only do they have the searchable, but they have a nice online reader.
Yes. Oh, it's beautiful.
It's a pleasure to go through reading stuff with their web-based reader.
So I found it slow.
Mm.
I haven't found it that way.
Yeah. No.
I think sometimes it has to do with how good my connection is at the time, because I had to push the right out to turn pages in Byte magazine, and most of the time they just flip over very nicely, and every so often I'd have something where it was sluggish. I don't know if it was the server it was being served off of or my connection was a little slow, but most of the time the slowness I have not seen to be an issue.
Okay.
So I've talked on the show about this new obsession that I have with the fourth language and environment. And so someone had pointed out to me, you should check out the edition that Byte did on fourth way back in the day. So I was able to go find it on archive.org. And you guys were talking about the ads. I was cycling through some of the ads and looking at the stuff and doing a little retro daydreaming. And I came across this ad for 86 DOS and the 8086 card plugin from Seattle Computer Products.
Ah.
This was the August of 1980 issue, so predating the IBM PC. And I thought it was so fascinating to see this, what looked like a full-page ad from Seattle Computer Products. Of course, the people who sold the rights to their 86 DOS to Microsoft, and the rest became history, literally.
Yes.
It wasn't 86 DOS the thing that came out of Quick and Dirty DOS, if I remember, for the S100s?
Yeah, that's what turned into Q&D DOS, I think.
Okay. Yeah, I thought so. Or I think it wasn't it the other way around. Wasn't it QD DOS?
Q&D must have come later because they say he sees this ad in 1980 for 86 DOS.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I never really used any of it, so I'm just going from vague memories. Yeah.
Yes. I didn't either. I didn't have an S100 system back then, but the big draw here from the ad was that you could take your CPM source code, you could recompile it into 8086 and do just a little fix-up, and all of a sudden have it running many times faster.
But that's magic. Burn the witch!
I know. It's black magic, isn't it? But so that ad was funny. I mean, it was just like, wow, that's a snapshot of history right there. So as well as drooling over, woo, yeah, like you were saying, Carrington, I'd love to have that and 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 a warehouse to put it all in.
But oh, yes.
I don't even like to collect stuff, and yet still I just love browsing through old computer ads.
Yes. So moving on to the next thing, more online resources, and especially for you, Carrington, because I know
all about me.
Yeah, I know how upset you were that you weren't able to make it to this year's Commodore Vegas Expo.
I can't believe they held it without me.
Well, they thought
it's
about
like Burning Man. You
got
to have that one thing you hoist up and light on fire. That was supposed to be me.
The Carrington effigy.
I am the Wicker Man of combat.
I think they waited an hour to start thinking you'd show up, but then they had to start anyway.
Yes, they did reluctantly. So if you go to blip.tv/BIOS, B-I-O-S is the channel on Blip TV, you're going to find a lot of videos over there from the Commodore Vegas Expo, Comvex, as it's known. A lot of them shot by Robert Bernardo, the man himself, the Super Commodore guy. And very interesting presentations.
I forgot all about Blip. I'm glad you're bringing that up just because I forgot about the existence of Blip.tv.
It's there, and there's lots of these cool videos. And for those, unlike Carrington, who might have some passing interest in Commodore, or a lot of interest
I have
in
a very passing interest in Commodore. Oh, look, past.
We will have that link in the show notes.
Cool.
So now I get to talk about gifts that people everywhere worldwide want to buy for me. You know, our retro computing gift idea for this episode, going along with my theme on the maker culture, I love the Adafruit site. And I love the Adafruit videos that they do on YouTube, and I love all this stuff. You were talking earlier, Carrington, about this maker stuff being more societally acceptable. And one of the things that they do over at Adafruit is have a whole set of stuff for wearable electronics. So if you don't just want to do your bling, but you want to show off your bling to the world, if you want to have some blinky LED earrings, for instance.
I do.
You can go to Adafruit and find out exactly how to do that. You can watch how-tos on how to put it together. The two specific items I'm going to talk about today are the NeoPixel Ring and the Adafruit Gemma. So first off, the NeoPixel Ring is a circular, as ring implies, group of 16 red, green, blue LEDs. And these LEDs are not just the LED themselves, but they also have some embedded electronics that make it easy to control them in a chain. So you chain a whole bunch of them together, and then you just stream a set of ones and zeros down the chain at the particular timing. And it sets the red, green, and blue dynamic on these things so that they're really neat devices.
I find this very exciting.
You connect it to a microcontroller like an Arduino or something. That's how you program it.
Yep. You connect it up to something like an Arduino, or there's some code out there now for the propeller to drive this particular device, which is a WS2812 for those who might be interested. But this RGB LED, they're neat. They make nice patterns.
And it's only $10.
Yeah, this NeoPixel Ring. Only $10.
And the Gemma's $8. Like, come on. This is awesome, Earl. Nice choice.
So the Gemma.
This is perfect.
I'm now down a rabbit hole on this site. There's like 1,000 cool things on this site. This is a great find.
Oh, I'm telling you, this site is great. Adafruit makes a couple of tiny embeddable microcontroller boards. One's called the Trinket. The other is this one, the Gemma. that they're tiny and they're based on the microcontroller chipset, the AT-Tiny.
So nice. I've been using a Teensy, which seems fairly similar. In fact, this trinket looks like my Teensy. I can't even visually, it looks like the same thing.
So, and when you're first starting to build this, you can, as they show on the YouTube video, hook it all up with alligator clips. Just, you know, do prototype it first, and then once you get the hang of it, then go ahead and solder it together and make all kinds of cool stuff. One YouTube video had a guy who took a couple of these NeoPixel rings and put them on his headphones. So you have these DJ, really cool, blinged out headphones that, you know, in the chaser patterns and things like that.
So, very nice. Very nice.
So that's my choice.
That is cool. Well, I'm going to come back to this site.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, nice.
And not a ton of money, like you guys were saying.
Nice and inexpensive. It's not, you know, it's totally affordable.
And if you're looking for, this is a great gift choice, Earl. If somebody has somebody they got to buy for who's into, like, the maker movement that we were talking about at the beginning, this is a perfect, like, stocking stuffer type gift. Like, this is fantastic for $10. Like, come on. That's nice.
It's a Radio Shack Merry Christmas.
Well, I remember that Christmas. Dad gave me my first shortwave radio from Radio Shack. What memories. This Christmas, we got our son's Color Computer 3 from Radio Shack. It hooks right up to our TV and was on sale for less than $130. The Color Computer 3 makes learning fun. Jimmy even lets me use it for word process when he isn't playing computer games. Lucky I still got my shortwave.
Save $70 on the sale-priced Color Computer 3, only at Radio Shack.
So other stuff we can buy. We do our normal segment on eBay. I do have to start with my typical rant that I found all kinds of crazy things on eBay this time in the vintage computer section, stuff that was not just 20% or 50% more than it should be, but a couple of items that I would love to put on the wall of shame that were at least an order of magnitude higher than they should have been. I won't say who, but somebody was trying to sell a Tandy microcomputer, microcolor computer, the MC10, for nearly $300. Now, these things go for like $30, $40 in really good condition, complete in the box. And this person was like, hey, an MC10, and it even works, so give me $300 for it. And I hope some poor slob doesn't come along going, hey, I'd like to have a retro computer and buy that thing for 10 times what it's worth. I was just shaking my head. But we go out and we do the work for you, so you don't have to do the work. We look for the good deals. And we'll start with Carrington. Carrington, tell us what the good deals are.
This isn't really that good of a deal. No, it's a pretty – actually, no, this is
– nice lead-in, Earl.
It's a pretty good deal. I, as you know, as everybody know, my favorite thing about old-school collectible software is ripping it open and destroying its collectible value. And I think others should share that. But unfortunately, a lot of times, if it's a good old-school game and it's shrink-wrapped, you got to invest $50, $100 to get that and then de-shrink-wrap it. So you better really want that new software smell.
But that's the real worth of it, right? It's not somebody trying to scam you. The collectible value of these things has they've risen to that level. Yeah. So it's not like
and as more and more people like me get their hands on it and rip over the shrink wrap, there are fewer and fewer options.
And so I help. What Carrington's going to buy.
Exactly. I help drive up the prices for the rest of you. Collectors shouldn't be mad at me. They should appreciate the fact that I add value to their collections by making them even more rare when I destroy the things they love. So if you want to destroy the things that I love, then one of the games that I adored from back when LucasArts was putting out some of the all-time best point-and-click games. There was a game called Full Throttle. I played the Mac version. There were lots of other versions available. But it was one of the most fun point-and-click experiences. It's not a very tough game. A lot of the old point-and-click games, like when you're playing something like Maniac Mansion, you got to take some logic leaps that are so difficult. I think when I saw that one even, I had to cheat at least once and look at a walkthrough and go, wait, I got to microwave the hamster to send it back in time or freeze it or whatever. Like, there's some things you're just not going to make the logic leap. The nice thing about Full Throttle is it's got a super high production value, but a normal puzzle-solving person can do the game. It's not that difficult, but it's got lots of humor, some action scenes in the middle. It really stretches what you can do with just a point-and-click game, and I adored it. So somebody online has some, and it's not that rare a game. It's the kind of game you can easily play in emulation. So, but if you want to play an old school actual game, like on original Mac with original CD, here's a chance to pick up a sealed copy of Full Throttle. This guy has four of them available, and they're $16 a piece. So you can open it up. You get a fresh, brand new experience. You get to unbox it for only $16. So it's cheap, but it's a great game. Highly recommended always. And it's also one of the early PowerPC games. So if you've got a PowerPC computer, and there wasn't a lot of stuff that wasn't running in like that weird emulation mode, so this was actually included the original Mac version, and also will run natively on an early PowerPC. So it's a great game if you've got like a PowerMac 6100 or something. It runs terrific on those. So $16, full sealed, great game. Love it. That's my choice.
Good.
Yeah.
Nice.
There was an alternate choice that I had considered just to point out, because another game I liked that came, I think this would be the year next year or something. Anyway, if it's according to the ad here, it's 1993, but it's Spectre VR. And what I liked about this game was, and this is $50, it's still in shrink wrap supposedly, but one of the photos shows the inside of the contents. So I'm like, okay, I don't know if those are from a different box or what. And this also not a very rare game, but weirdly seems to sell for quite a bit. So this comes up on eBay all the time from other sellers, and normally is from $70 to $100 to get a shrink wrap version. And I think it's because Spectre came in a really interesting box. It was the time when like Prince of Persia was coming out, and there was all these weird box shapes, and it's in that period of coming up to the mid-90s. So it's got this weird kind of pointy shape, and so it's a really fun box. So if you buy old software for a display, this is a nice box to display. But it's also one of my favorite early networked games for the Mac. So multiple people could get this version in the box would come with the solo version and also one network node. So using the one box, you can set up two computers and you play against each other. And there weren't a lot of games of this sort that you could play on a Mac and play like a network head-to-head game. And this was a really good implementation of one. So it's really fun. And it's only $50, which I still think is a lot for this game. But it is shrink wrapped and it's a cool box and it's collectible and it's also a fun game. So that's my alternate choice.
Great. We'll have both of those up on the
show. I went Macintosh instead of Apple II. I had 3-year curve.
So how long before they close?
Quite a bit. The Spectre one has, it's a buy it now, and it's $50, and it has 27 days left, so whenever you want. And the other one also has, like, no time limit for the Full Throttle. It's done as a store thing, so it's really just he's got four available, and when those four sell, they'll be gone, so.
I see. Good. Yeah. Well, people hearing the podcast might have a shot at it.
Yeah, the Full Throttle in particular, only $16. It's a really good game for early Macintosh. Really, really fun. Totally worth the $16.
So what have you got for us, Dr. Steve?
Well, of course, the problem I had looking for something on eBay is I was just looking, there's like tons of stuff, and I couldn't really find anything that really caught my eye. And I swear, I looked for something that said, you know, ZX. I looked for something that said Z80. There's none of those things on there. They have Z80s and ZXs.
What is that?
But there's none of those Z things on the eBay. I looked.
Oh, but, how disappointing. The Queen is upset about this.
But I found something that popped up in Twitter earlier today that I thought was hilarious, that there is somebody selling, I don't have the link on our notes, but there's somebody selling Apple IIc Owner's Manual and Apple IIc Reverence Manual. So if you want to be really nice to your Apple IIc and you want to revere it, there is a Reverence Manual.
I'm totally sacrilegious when it comes to my Apple IIc.
So this would be a way to help you learn not to be that.
Well, I usually use my Apple IIc prostrate, so I'm on the ground leaning with my hands up, and I can't see it. So if I could get a manual, that would help a lot.
Yeah, that would help. So I can give you the link for that if you want. But the other thing I did find is I found somebody has taken a probably something that was on a movie projector like I wanted to run in high school that was played from the 50s. It's something IBM made talking about the history of Sage computer. This is the big iron, you know, old school stuff. And there's actually three films. There's something, the story of a surveillance computer system, the Sage. It says it was the physically largest computer ever built, occupying two floors at IBM and 1,000,000 watts of power.
Holy crap. The Sage was a defense computer, right? Am I
56,000 electron tubes for that puppy.
Oh my God.
Okay. Wow. And then there's another movie that's black and white about logic by machine, computers in the mind of man, and then a color kind of cartoon about the information machine. So the guy's taken these old films that apparently are out of copyright. Copyrights have expired, and he's put them on a DVD so you can look at them. So if you want to look back and see the funny stuff that they did with big old computers back in the day, that's where you could find this.
And for $4.
Yeah, $4 to get
and
it.
Also, and technically, you can buy it and burn your own copy if it's out of copyright and put it right back on eBay for $3 and, you know.
You could, but I mean, at $4, you're probably not making a ton of money.
That's true, right?
But yeah, awesome. I would like to see these things.
If I had a Dr. Strangelove style open room of some sort, I would have a Sage computer in it. It'd be awesome.
Oh, yes.
With a radar thing on it. It'd be fantastic.
The blinky lights and the tape drive spinning around.
Absolutely.
You know, it's exactly what you'd need to have your secret lair.
That'd be the best Kansas Fest room ever.
It would. It'd be hello, NORAD calling. So I picked a Warrior telecoupler.
Ooh.
Yes. It's a vintage Road Warrior telecoupler. And so back in the day, if you were shuttling around from country to country.
I think I had this.
Did you?
As soon as I opened, I hadn't opened up your Lincoln. I'm like, hold on. I think I owned this thing.
So, you know, let's say that you're like a globetrotter.
I was.
and you want to be able to sign in to the Master Blaster computer from wherever you are. Then you would want one of these acoustic couplers, a bunch of connectors, and about a zillion different, well, it says 11 to 14 different countries' telephone plug and adapters.
My gosh, there are all those plugs.
Yeah, and yeah, I had the same little pouch that this guy, I had this exact thing. This is crazy. This may be previously owned by me.
So I just thought I've always been interested in the old acoustic modems. I think they're great. I have one that I have to refurbish. I have an old Epson, and the fun thing about the Epson was it was actually NiCad battery operated, so you could carry it around and, you know, rock on 300 baud wherever you happen to be. But this guy, you could go all over the world with. So I just thought it was fascinating. And right now, it's got 8 days left. There are no bids on it, $5 and $10 shipping. So it seemed like a bit of memorabilia that would be actually affordable.
Yes.
Very cool. Very cool. Because I remember this. In fact, it's got RS-232 to alligator clip plug adapter and all of that. I'm like, I have this exact thing. And you'd look and say, well, what power adapter do I need and like to convert over for the plug and stuff? And also, what do I need to convert for the different shape plug for the phone or even tap right in with the alligator clips? It was awesome. I love this thing.
So what time period did you have this?
Oh, God, I don't know. Like, I this vague memory of, like, as soon as I looked at it, I'm like, I traveled with this. I was in Europe with this thing. I remember the gray, I could feel the bumps on the top of the back of it. It's got these weird bumps, and that's what made me remember this thing. I'm like, I remember the feel of that. Like, what a stupid design with these weird bumps that would stick up. And,
I saw those. I wondered if they had any function.
No, or if I remember, they were just bumps that stuck up. Like, gosh, this was forever ago. But not like crazy. This wasn't like a 1980s thing. I think I had this in the early 90s. Like, I don't think it was that. Like, I know that's still super retro. I'm old enough to not think it's that retro. But
the appearance of it doesn't make me think of 80s. 90s would make more sense. But it just looks like. I didn't think anybody was using an acoustic coupler in the 1990s as all. But
and I had it because I was traveling. And I think. I'm trying to think what computer did I use, because that would tell us. I think it was. I was using this with a Mac Duo of some sort, and not the first Duo. So I owned a 210 or whatever the one that was a three-digit Duo, and I think I was using this with the four-digit Duo. So that would have been the 2100 or something that came with the Duo dock. So I think that was the computer I was using with this. So sometimes that's how I remember things in my life. When did that happen? When did my nephew graduate from public school? I don't know. What computer
circle
did I bring?
What was my computer?
Totally. My whole history is based on the technology I was using. Then I looked up from which computer and saw that happen. So I think this is that era. So anyway, wasn't super old.
Lots happened in modems between the late 80s and the mid 90s.
Right.
That was an amazing period of innovation. with modems. So you could have had something like this in the late 80s, and by the time the mid-90s came around, had something that was fantastically faster.
Right.
And so anyway,
cool.
Yep. So that was my pick. So now we get to the closing discussions. And Carrington, you've been fooling around with the show doc again. So
it's a topic that I think is perfect for everyone to
So the topic on the table is Carrington is awesome. Discuss.
Just pitching it as a potential.
With that, let's start with you.
Carrington is awesome. I'm fully in favor of this. I see no defenses.
Do you endorse that?
I do. I'm Carrington, and I endorse this message about me being awesome. Absolutely. Carrington is busy, is what Carrington is, but also awesome. Not enough time for retro stuff in my life. I'm doing lots of podcasts, and that's fun, and that's been great, and we just hit the one-year anniversary for No Quarter, and so that's been super fun. We didn't miss a single week. We did 52 for 52. That's a record for me. It's a record for podcasting in general, I think. Nobody goes on, and it's all because of Mike. That is strictly because Mike keeps me on time, and he's just like, he gets it done, and I'm the talking monkey who just joins him on his show, so I can take no credit, but remarkably, yeah, we got 52 for 52, so that was super fun. And just, I picked up, speaking of sealed software for me to open up and enjoy the smell of the discomfort of other collectors, I've been trying to get a sealed copy of every single Infocom game for the Apple II. And it's rare because I, for the most part, I won't pay the price. A sealed Infocom game, even the late crappy ones, not that there's any really bad ones, but they'll be like $100. And it's just, that's, to me, a ridiculous price to pay for a piece of software that you can get for free online.
Yes.
So I can never bite the bullet. But so I'm constantly looking for deals, though, and I'm trying to get things. So I I've had a few of the big ones. Like, I've had the suspended mask box for ages, and that's sealed, and so that's exciting. Although I keep hurting it. Like, every time I touch it, I seem to poke another piece through the brittle shrink wrap. So I'm going to have to open that one up soon because I'm slowly destroying it, not on camera. And I gotta videotape it and open it.
But you are opening it. It's just time lapse.
Right. Yes. But I should be actually recording while I do this, because that's the goal, is to record the inside. I'm very interested, as an aside, in documenting why I've been collecting this sealed software. And I like to open up it. I've been videotaping and taking lots of photos as I open it up, because I want to document not just the contents, because there's been lots of documentation of the contents of software. Like, you can go online and lots of people have scanned everything in the world and they've done lots of effort I wouldn't do. What I'm trying to document is the actual assembly of the stuff. So when you open up a box, what was the order the things were there? And I don't think anybody cares, but I also don't think anybody's taken that into account. And that's what I'm trying to document. It's like, when you open up a sealed box of this Infocom game, there are 7 pieces of paper, and this is the order they're in. Because if somebody wants to reassemble it, and you're a super anal guy, you don't want to necessarily just get everything. You might want to put them in the right order. I don't know. It's one of those things where I don't know. You never know what might be useful info later on, but I'm thinking it might be useful because it could be a way where somebody buys a shrink wrap piece of software and you open it up and go, that's not the order this is supposed to be in. It can help you know that this is a reshrink or a fake one or whatever. So I'm trying to document, does this seem like a real one or bad? Because I've got some also shrink wrap pieces of software that I know are not original shrink. And so I'm really not sure what I want to do with it, but that sort of idea. But anyway, I finally got a hold of a shrink wrapped original Flying Saucer for Infocom game. And I've wanted this one forever, but it's just like impossible to get without paying $1 billion. So I finally picked up, which is Starcross, the first one. So I finally got a Starcross Flying Saucer, still shrink wrapped, and it didn't cost me, $700. So I'm really pleased. Yeah. It's in rough shape, but it's mine. Mwah, mine. And I will open it.
Yeah, that's one of the more iconic ones.
Yeah,
wouldn't you say?
Yeah, there's a few of the really big ones, like the mask and the saucer are, like, I guess, the two most iconic. But then I'm interested in even the original ones. Like, I love Infocom games in general and the feelies they included, and like, there's for me, every single one of them is a wonderful child, and I love them all. And I just love their games and everything they did. But in particular, I like their early ones. So, and even things like Witness and that kind of stuff where you get in Deadline, which are, bigger boxes, but not necessarily quite as iconic as the Mask or the Flying Saucer, but trying to get them all.
So you must have watched at least once the Infocom special part on GetLamp.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, GetLamp is fantastic. I have my coin. I was an early buyer of that, so I've got a coin with a number, and love it, love it, love it, love it.
Your number is probably earlier than mine.
Yeah, but it's not super low. When I was talking with people at Kansas Fest when we talked about this, and I think three different people, all mm-hmm. of whom had numbers way lower than mine. They would see the number. I'm like, I don't know what mine is, but it's higher than that. So mine's low, but it's not that low.
But did you get your copy? What's that?
I've got a coin around here, but I just can't remember what the number is. Mm-hmm. I have to look for where I've stored it. But anyway.
Well, so what about you, Dr. Steve? Parting shots? Not passing shots. That's a whole different game.
Actually, my aim is bad
He's
enough.
Doing
it probably
shots.
Would be passing shots. No, I'm doing some study for a recertification exam I need to take for doctor stuff. And
is that what it's actually called? Doctor stuff exam?
Doctor stuff, exactly. Nice. I hope to have that certification for doctor stuff sometime soon. But also getting the last bits and pieces of this Apple II history book hopefully wrapped up really soon now. So there will be such a thing available to buy for those who have pre-ordered from 6 months ago.
That's really exciting.
Yeah, it is. I'm waiting for that book with bated breath. Well, my breath is always a little fishy. But so for the doctor stuff exam, do you ever wind up on Medscape?
Not too often. When I look at doctor stuff, I've got actually something I'm paying a subscription to called Up to Date, where they keep all the latest information on there that's not being sponsored by a pharmaceutical company or whatever. And
big pharma.
So it's hopefully as objective as possible without any leaning one way or the other. That's my go-to primarily for when I want to find something that I don't already know. And frankly, I don't even own a textbook anymore that's current, because even when you bought those things, they were out of date by the time you bought them.
Right.
Now with Up to Date, it's up to date. So
very good. Well, that's awesome. Well, on my side, I hear you about being busy. Things are really busy here. Work's been awful busy the last few weeks, too. So I don't have as much retro time as I want either. But I did manage to finally work up the courage to buy a keyboard for my other VT100 terminal. It's one of the last retro acquisitions that I want to make for a while, so that I have the VT100 and the spare. I like having spares for the things that I have, so that it gives me a level of confidence that when I turn them on, that even if the magic smoke comes out, that I'm not sitting there just left in a lurch. Yeah. I can just go grab the spare and start tearing into it and make, you know, whatever repairs are necessary.
But, I used to think that way, but increasingly I'm just thinking, if it's something dies, I'll just go on eBay and wait for a cheap replacement.
I used to think that way myself, but it's been scaring me off recently, the precipitous increases on everything.
Oh, yeah.
It's
years ago, I had people, because of my Apple II history website, I had some folks who would send me an email that says, hey, I got this collection with an Apple II Plus. You want it? And it's like, had I been thinking, I would have said sure, but at the time, it's like, I know where to store it. Now, you want to get an Apple II Plus, you're going to have to drop, you know, $300-$500.
Yeah, that stuff is getting crazy. The pluses have gotten bonkers for not even like collectible ones, just a run of the mill late model Apple II Plus. I can't believe the cost people are looking for nowadays.
Even for 2Es, there's like a lot of my, when I was looking for eBay stuff, there's a lot with teeth missing, you know, the keys that are off the keyboard, that they were asking for far more than they should be. So if you want to get pieces, even if the smoke goes out of it, it's like, yeah, you could go wait on eBay, but it may cost you a lot more.
So of the stuff that I want to keep, I want to try and have spares, and of the stuff that I don't want to keep, I want to start to divest myself of it. That's my strategy, and I'm sticking to it. Last time we talked about, do you collect to just have or collect to use? And my goal is collect to use, whereas inadvertently, in some of these cases, I've wound up collecting just to have.
Right.
So
you're a hoarder.
So I'm trying to turn the corner on that. So that's my deal.
In terms of turning the corner, is Chicken Lips number one on iTunes yet?
No.
I was hanging, dragging my feet on getting Chicken Lips 1 until I could just get it from through the iTunes podcast feed.
I'm actually hoping this week to record number 2 and then to go over to Mr. iTunes and plead.
Well, the first one, the title was Why I Love Commodore, right? So the second one could be Why I Still Love Commodore. Like every episode yes. would just be like, love the Commodore.
Why 2.5 years later, I'm still into it.
Just checking in. Yep, love it. And your shows will get shorter and shorter. Yeah, I still love it. And see you next month.
Exactly. Nice. I mean, I could just get to, you know, where the episodes are. Yes. And then move forward.
Yeah, too would like to subscribe through iTunes. I just went online and just listened on the site and also keep waiting for it to appear on iTunes. So come on. Get
all
on,
right.
girl.
You guys are giving me the requisite kick in the behind.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
So I will take that as an action.
I did see that you had an RSS feed, but I'm like, I want to subscribe in iTunes. because I click on the subscribe in iTunes, it's like a vote in iTunes. So I can just put your RSS feed into iTunes. But then that doesn't, I think, count as a subscription. Like if you go in the iTunes store and you click in iTunes subscribe, I think the podcast gets a benefit from you doing that. So I'm holding off to try to help you, dude.
And yeah. not just that, but that I don't know what you found with your podcast, Carrington, but the overwhelming majority of the downloads that I get on my stats are from iTunes.
Oh, huge. Big times. Mostly because I don't bother promoting anywhere else. Mm-hmm. So that might be a self-fulfilling prophecy.
And you don't really have to. And I mean, there's getting to be enough retro podcasts now where there's cross-pollinization. You go on iTunes and you go, I want to look at, this podcast, the Retro Computing Roundtable. Well, you'll see a link over to the Antic podcast.
Yeah, because the same people subscribe to, and Antic is one people should definitely subscribe to. Mm-hmm. And the same, if listeners of one often, we all listen to the same shows, I think.
Yep.
Although the Apple iOS podcast app is still as crap as ever and constantly makes me want to go to something else. But I do try to make sure that I think by using that, again, I'm helping the podcast that I listen to so Apple knows about them because I want them to be promoted. The shows I listen to are shows I really enjoy. So I try to help them out, but man, that is a terrible application.
I think if you get them through iTunes, you still do it. I've using Downcast on my phone when I listen to iPod or iTunes, podcasts, and Downcast just works better. I haven't really gone back to the Apple one even after they remodeled.
Maybe I'll try that then, because I hate the podcast app for Apple.
Ugh. I had to pay for Downcast, but it was worth it. It just works better.
Yeah. Cool.
Very cool. Well, that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for all the RCR shows, including this one, at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss in the forums over at vintage-computer.com/VC forum. And while you're there, you should hang out on some of the other topical forums on the Vintage Computer forums because they are great. You can follow the RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast. You can send us feedback. We love feedback. So if you'd like, shoot us some feedback at, drumroll please, feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And as we just mentioned, you can write a review on iTunes. We would very much appreciate it. Gentlemen, it's been a pleasure as always. And until next time,
Retro Compute.
Retro Compute.
See you guys.